Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts of the George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. She's off today. Next month marks the 150th anniversary of President Abraham Lincoln's death. The first American president to be assassinated, Lincoln's death touched off widespread public mourning on a scale the nation had never seen before. In a new book titled Mourning Lincoln, author Martha Hodes traces the varied reactions of ordinary Americans to Lincoln's death from diaries, letters, and other personal accounts. Martha Hodes, who is also a professor of history at NYU, joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great
nice to
be here.
Have us. And, of course, you can join us, as always, 1-800-433-8850. drshow@wamu.org, email address, and join this conversation. Of course, a well-timed book, Martha, given the interest in Lincoln. Of course, there's always interest in Lincoln. That's part of the point of your book. And I was struck that when you talk about where you got this idea from, I mean, there have been countless books written about Abraham Lincoln. Why one more? But I was interested to learn that some of the seeds for this idea came from your own experience at 9/11. Tell the readers about that.
Yes, that's right. So I've been teaching the Civil War for almost 25 years, and I always say a little bit about Lincoln and the assassination. But I found myself over the last few years saying more about Lincoln and the assassination. And then, as you said, I trace that back to my own experiences. During 9/11, I was in New York City. It was the first day of class, the first day of the fall semester at NYU. Mm. I had just left my apartment when the first plane hit, saw the second plane hit, went to class. The students who had seen everything before their eyes came in, sat in their chairs, and we began to go over the syllabus. What I realized later was we just didn't realize the magnitude of the event. It was a manifestation of shock. Finally, somebody opened the classroom door and said, the towers fell down. And I said, okay, class dismissed. And then it began to dawn on me. And so as a scholar of the Civil War, I began to wonder how people responded personally, wherever they were when they heard the news. And that was the seed of the book.
And also you talk about the childhood memories of the other, alas, many assassinations in the 60s, but the assassination of Jack Kennedy was really also part of your own history.
Yes, that's right. So I was only 5 years old in 1963, and I have a very brief memory of walking down the street with the woman who was taking care of my sister and me. She was a devout Catholic. She had a transistor radio, listening to the developments, tears streaming down her face. And that's the only memory I have. And as a historian, I stopped myself from embroidering that. But I have since talked to people who were grown-ups at the time. And I asked my father what he was doing when Kennedy was assassinated. And he had been in a...
Everybody knows.
Everybody remembers. He had been in an auto parts store buying parts for his Ford. The man behind the counter had heard the news on the radio, brought out the radio for the customers to hear. And as my father told me, everybody completed their purchases. And that also resonated with much of what I found in my research, that everyday life continued to some extent in the course of all of this shock.
But also the other aftermath that Kennedy and 9/11 and Martin Luther King's assassination,
yes,
Robert Kennedy's assassination, was the rather quick veneration and almost martyrdom. You quote in your book one African-American saying, Lincoln has been crucified. there are these parallels of these very public and traumatic deaths trigger these reactions in people, and you can see the pattern.
Yes, and Lincoln especially is very interesting. First, he's compared to George Washington as a great president, although African-Americans do not make that comparison because Washington was a slaveholder. They're very clear about the distinction. Then there's Moses, and that's a comparison that African-Americans make frequently. And then there's Jesus. And, of course, Lincoln was assassinated on Good Friday. He died on Saturday morning, and the next day was Easter Sunday. So the parallels with Jesus were inescapable. And that was something that both black and white mourners made. And it was also something that happened immediately. It didn't happen over time. It happened right away, the deification of Lincoln.
There's also the deification of Lincoln leads to an idea that Jill Lepore in the New York Times raises in her review of your book, where she talks about the civic religion that grew up almost as Lincoln as a deity. And talk about that dimension of the legacy.
Well, what was so fascinating about the moment of the assassination, and this is related to the Good Friday, Easter Sunday moment, mourners were absolutely confused to an incredible degree as to why God would have taken Lincoln away at the moment of Union victory. It was so hard to understand. And so they went to church on Easter Sunday looking to find answers from their ministers. And of course, the ministers had produced Easter Sunday sermons, which were joyful, and then immediately had to rewrite those sermons, preserving some of the joy of Easter Sunday, but also reckoning with the assassination. And part of what this civic religion was, part of what ministers had to say, was that Union victory was God's will and wasn't that wonderful, but God had a greater plan in assassinating Lincoln. Now, we don't know what it is yet, but something even better is going to happen. And that became part of the public rituals and the wrestling with faith and this idea that God was implicated in the creation of the nation, of the American nation.
But there was also, in terms of the concept of a civic religion, which is a vibrant idea in American history, and Lincoln was almost a saint of the American civic religion, that he stood for certain values that were central to the American experience. And that is very much a part of the memory and the veneration, right? It's not just he was a good president. He stood for larger ideas.
What's so fascinating about Lincoln, and we see this as soon as the assassination comes to pass, the freed people, former slaves and free African Americans in the North, they immediately say Lincoln was our best friend. So they, now don't forget, of course, African Americans had been critical of Lincoln during the war because he had been slow to act on emancipation.
Sure.
But of course, he had been greatly influenced by black and white abolitionists and had come around the Emancipation Proclamation, the second inaugural address. Then what I found so fascinating in my research was that Confederates, who are also gleeful about the assassination, they also call Lincoln their best friend at the same moment that they're reveling in the assassination. And that was Lincoln's genius as a statesman, and that was part of his deification. I thought that Lincoln as the Confederates' best friend would be something I would find as part of a later lost cause development. But we're talking Saturday morning, April 15th, Confederates were saying he was their best friend because they were fearful of President Andrew Johnson.
But also, there had been, as you write in your book, Martha Hodes, a certain leniency and moderation to Lincoln's approach to this issue. He, as you point out, he was slow to meet the demands of the most radical abolitionists. The radical Republicans even tried to nominate someone other than Lincoln for his renomination because he wasn't as determined and as aggressive, right, in abolishing slavery as they wanted. So we remember him as the great emancipator, but there was always a significant element of moderation and leniency to the way he dealt with this issue.
The issue of lenience in Lincoln is so fascinating. What I found, and I didn't expect to find this, was this goes back to the question about wrestling with faith. So people were wondering when Lincoln was assassinated, well, did God take Lincoln away because he was too lenient and he would have treated the Confederates too moderately? Or are we supposed to look to Lincoln and his lenience as a model for how to act now that he's gone? Well, in a way, what happens is people decide, or I should say the most radical black and white mourners decide, that God took Lincoln away because he was too lenient. Then African Americans and their white allies take this another step. They refashion Lincoln into a radical, and they look back to the Emancipation Proclamation, to the last speech he gave on April 11th, where he talks about black suffrage, and the second inaugural, which, of course, famously makes the Civil War about slavery. So Lincoln went through a kind of transformation very rapidly after the assassination. Too lenient, but then he's going to be our model of radicalism.
And you also point out that there at the time, you quote these articles, say the country is plunged into universal mourning, when in fact there were significant expressions, as you point out, of glee and joy and satisfaction in the South. I have a granddaughter who attends a school in Raleigh, North Carolina, and part of their legacy is that after Lincoln was assassinated, the headmaster had to say to the girls, "Don't cheer." I mean, this is part of their history.
That's very interesting because Confederates, what I came to see in reading personal responses was that Confederates reveled in the assassination at the same time as they called Lincoln their best friend, partly because the moment of surrender and defeat was such a moment of despair. And so in Lincoln's assassination, there was a moment of reprieve and a moment of the victor's suffering, which is something that was a relief to them. But Confederates knew that it was just a moment. They knew that they had still lost the war. As far as cheering and clapping and laughing, lots of evidence of that, but also evidence of Confederates writing in private and saying, you know, I need to stay home or I'm not going to go outside. There were, however, people who did laugh, clap and cheer in public and were visited by violence from mourners.
And one of the things that, as you point out, was also true that once Lincoln was gone, there was the specter of Andrew Johnson. And so it wasn't just Lincoln, it was who was he succeeded by, and that tempered some of the glee in the South.
Andrew Johnson is such a fascinating case here because most people thought he would be harder on the Confederates than Lincoln. And they thought that because Andrew Johnson was known to hate the Southern aristocracy. On the other hand, Andrew Johnson was a poor white Southerner. Was his
From
roots
Tennessee.
Were his that's right, his, those were his roots. And he hated Black people more than he hated the Southern aristocracy.
Martha Hodes, she's her new book is Mourning Lincoln. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. And give us a call. We got some lines open. Send us a tweet or an email. We'll answer your questions. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to ensure all students graduate from high school prepared for success in college and career, and supporting innovation that can improve public schools at gatesfoundation.org. From Patricia Papper, supporting Perez Art Museum Miami, providing progressive art programming and cultural experiences to Miami-Dade County residents and visitors, on the web at pamm.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts from George Washington University. I'm sitting in today for Diane while she's off, and my guest this hour is Martha Hodes, who is a professor of history at New York University, and her new book is called Mourning Lincoln. And, of course, Martha, time to coincide with just in a few weeks, the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's assassination. And one of the devices you use in this book, you spend a lot of time consulting diaries, letters, of ordinary people, and you build to some extent. We were talking just before the break on you had the northern view and the southern view, and that you've chose to highlight two northerners, Albert and Sarah Brown, abolitionists, rabid abolitionists, and then the southerner Rodney Dorman. Talk about why you why and how you use these two figures or these three figures to illustrate the larger public reaction to Lincoln's death.
The first thing I want to say is I try to stay away from North versus South because the South also included African Americans who were on the Union side. So I tend to say Union
Fair
Confederate.
Enough.
The Union side, I thread through the book the story of, as you said, two abolitionists, Sarah and Albert Brown from Massachusetts, absolutely devastated by Lincoln's assassination. And Sarah Brown, the wife, has kept a diary, and she wrote many letters, and very politically engaged, very engaged with the military actions of the war, absolutely fascinating source. And I picked them because their correspondence was so voluminous. Albert was away during the war working for the Union Army down south, and they have a voluminous correspondence and her diary. Then on the Confederate side, it's a wonderful diary from the Library of Congress by a man named Rodney Dorman, who was a diehard rebel. Absolutely disgusted with Lincoln's mourners, absolutely despises Lincoln. He is not someone who would ever say that Lincoln was a best friend of the Confederates. And his diary, he was a lawyer, very smart man, and he was living in Jacksonville, Florida during the war. That's where he was from. And he was just so viciously anti-Lincoln that it's a wonderful counterpart. The two stories together so nicely represent two ends of the spectrum. And also what they represent is the way in which, even with Confederate defeat and Union victory, the animosity and antagonism does not go away. It's so strong and so rabid when, at the moment, the war is over.
And also, they both illustrate how deeply people felt on both sides. This was, in
Absolutely.
Some ways, the unifying effect Lincoln had was that everybody had a strong opinion
That's
on both
right.
sides.
That's right.
Which, does that sound familiar to you in modern American politics?
You know, when I was reading, especially the Browns and Dorman, there is a resonance with people on different sides of an issue talking over and past one another. And that's very much what I found at this moment at the end of the Civil War. And it's one of the reasons that it was so interesting to me to write a book about this moment, represented by victory, defeat, and then assassination. You really can see the roots of irreconcilable visions of the nation's future. I didn't go into the book thinking it would be irreconcilable, but that is what I found.
Well, you know, in the first hour this morning, we had a conversation about the Supreme Court case that was argued yesterday, and we had callers calling in saying the Confederate flag stands for honor and heritage and defending our homeland, and others calling in to say the Confederate flag stands for repression and racism and slavery. And 150 years since that moment of Lincoln's assassination, that discussion, which you reflect in the diaries, is still going on.
Perfect example, and I did catch some of that hour. The only thing I'd add there is that I'm not sure anybody on your show said this last hour. The Confederate flag, no matter what it may have stood for Confederates, was waved as a symbol of the anti-civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. So in other words, people who were against Brown versus Board of Education, against segregation, desegregation of the schools, I should say, they waved the Confederate flag. And so its roots go back to the Civil War, but it has been invoked in many other ways that were racist campaigns. And that, I think, is more in people's memories, even than the Civil War.
And one of the things that you, Martha Hodes, you talk about in the book, you start the book with the actual assassination and John Wilkes Booth, very familiar story to many of us. But you talk about what happened with Lincoln's wounded body being taken across the street to a boarding house right here in Washington. And one of the interesting dimensions of the scene was people were pretty sure he was going to die. At that time, a head wound was invariably fatal. And yet people gathered, 20, 30 people in this small crowded room, hoping to hear last words from the great man. A very poignant dimension of this scene.
The first thing I should say about the room at Peterson House is that it was a tiny little room. Of course, you can go visit it today. It's a National Historic Site. The room was so small that the images and representations of it that we see with 30 people in there are actually an idealized version. And the vision of Lincoln lying in bed is also quite sanitized. His eye was protruding from the gunshot wound. The pillow was soaked with blood. But yes, you're quite right. People came and went into and out of that room, hoping that Lincoln would say some last words. He did not, which is one of the reasons, I think, that people reached for the proclamation, the last speech he made on April 11th from the White House balcony.
The second inaugural.
And the second inaugural, especially the second inaugural, which, by the way, was already famous at the moment of the assassination.
And then the other somewhat grisly but a meaningful dimension of this scene was people saved relics. And we were talking earlier about the veneration, almost the martyrdom, almost sainthood. Deification was the word you used. this is a very common human impulse that we see throughout human history of a preservation of relics of the saints. And this really was a pattern that we saw with Lincoln.
Absolutely. And so relics were part of it. So just to give one example, while everyone's rushing out of Ford's Theater on 10th Street, one government clerk rushes in, goes up to the box, and swipes the bloody collar that had been discarded so that Lincoln could breathe better, pockets it, and later it ends up in a historical society with a long letter and a long note about how it's been passed on. So relics are part of the religious aspect. The other is pilgrimages. So Ford's Theater was closed in the aftermath of the assassination, but people still came to Washington, went to the theater, walked around it, walked to the back alley where John Wilkes Booth had escaped on his horse, and Peterson House was a boarding house. It was open for business. And the room had been, it hadn't been cleaned. So I have this wonderful diary of a Boston woman who comes down, she goes to Peterson House, and then she writes a letter saying, I felt I had to do this because, first of all, she says, this is a historical fact. Those are her words. And then she says, and standing there, she can see the bloody pillow, made it, and these are her words, so vivid. So it's a way, relics and pilgrimages are ways to make what seems incomprehensible real.
And often they're combined because people will make a pilgrimage to a site of a relic.
Absolutely right. That's right.
You also talk, one of the most interesting parts of the book is describing after his death and then the train that recreates or reverse journey. Of course, he came originally to Washington by train, but he had to come in secretly when he arrived because there was such a threat of violence to him that he was spirited into Washington before the inauguration. And here, you know, 4+ years later, he leaves on this train, and you describe the scene, and you say that, as best you can tell, 1 million people saw the body.
It was really quite an amazing journey. So you're quite right. It reversed the trip that Lincoln took when he was becoming president for the first time. So it was a 1,700-mile, 2-week journey. The train stopped in 11 different cities, and there were 11 different funerals. That was after the funeral in Washington. But what was almost more interesting to me than those, which were amazing public rituals in which, you are correct, people viewed the body was removed from the train and brought to usually the state house in each city. But what I found so fascinating was the in-between journey. Every place the train passed through, every little station, every little town, it would move slowly. There was a very exact schedule. People would know, say, that the funeral train will pass through our town or a town 50 miles away at 3:26 in the morning. And they would come down, light bonfires, stand out in the rain, in the cold, in the mud, hold up their children, get down on their knees, pay tribute to Lincoln's body passing through on this train, no matter where it was or what time of day or night or what the weather was. Amazing.
And by consulting the diaries and the letters, you capture what people were feeling at the time, not what they thought they were feeling even a few weeks or months later. And what was so striking was people had an immediate sense of history. As you point out, people understood in the real time the importance of this. The countless history books that you and others have written, they didn't need that. They understood really at the moment the power and importance and that they wanted their children to share it. And as you have this wonderful line that's saying, people knew that their kids would remember this moment their whole life.
Yes, and so you bring up a really good point. I don't use memoirs in the book. Now, memoirs are a wonderful source. They're a wonderful historical source. But this is a book about the immediate, as you
right,
said,
exactly.
Real time, the moment. So people don't have time to craft their memoirs. Just to give one great example, Lincoln's body was carried out of Ford's Theater to Peterson House. Huge numbers of men remembered carrying the body, more than could ever fit around a human body.
Right,
so that tells you something about memoirs. And you're absolutely right about what I call in the book participation in history. People would write letters saying, an aunt wrote to her little niece saying, you will be glad that you were alive at this time. People said things like, I have lived 500 years of history in 1 week. I have lived more history than will ever be able to be accounted for in the course of a few days. They really understood that they were participating in something enormous, and they were right.
And, you know, we think you said earlier, Martha, about the moment you were only five, but I was in college when Kennedy was killed, and that anybody of that age remembers exactly where they were and what happened. Mm-hmm. And we sort of think, well, that was the age of television, and we were united as a country, and this is very common cliche that America watched, which we did in real time, the funeral services. But what you're saying is almost 100 years before that, long before television, let alone tweets and texts, people found a way to connect and in real time. That they didn't need these modern devices to do it.
Well, what I found so fascinating exactly on that point, I remembered, I did have this memory, and also I know this from studying Kennedy's assassination, that not everybody had a TV in those days, and there used to be something called appliance stores, and right. There were televisions in the window.
In the windows.
And so people congregated around those televisions to watch the news about Kennedy's assassination passing. When Lincoln was assassinated, people did something else. They went out into the street and looked into one another's faces to confirm that this terrible thing had happened, that it wasn't a dream, that it wasn't something that was misreported. And if they saw numbers of faces with tears or shock or grief, then they knew that had happened. And over again, people wrote in their diaries and letters, I went outside, I looked into people's faces. That was the means of confirmation, along, of course, with the telegraph and the newspapers, which, of course, weren't always correct. But people's faces were the main means of confirmation, like the television was for
us. Fascinating. And another point you make that is so interesting, but let me do a bit of business here. I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You also point out that this comes at the end of this terribly bloody and disastrous conflict, 700,000 deaths in the course of the Civil War, and that people, for better or worse, were used to mourning, and that everybody had been touched by the carnage of war, and that not only were mourning rituals so ever present, but people had they had black armbands, they had mourning dress. That people talk about Lincoln as the last casualty of the Civil War. You point out that's not true because people died of their wounds for months and years afterwards. But still, given the time, mourning was a more prominent part, and civic mourning was a more prominent part of American life at that moment when Lincoln was killed, because people had just gone through these four horrible years of war.
One thing that I think helps put in perspective the quantity of death during the Civil War, you said 750,000 deaths during that time, 2% of the U.S. population, an equivalent number today would be 7 million lives lost. So that gives us a sense of how everybody knew somebody, father, husband, son, brother, neighbor, friend. People had been mourning for 4 years, on both sides, by the way, needless to say.
Sure, of course.
Lincoln's funeral was important also because not all bodies could be returned to their families, especially Northern families. Most bodies were discarded on the battlefield, and people couldn't afford to have them preserved or embalmed or brought north. So Lincoln's funeral did give people a chance to mourn in a larger sense. And in diaries and letters, what I would find is that when Lincoln was assassinated, people would then write about their other losses. They would say, my dear son died in 1862 in the war. So it gave them a chance, both sadly and in a way that was important, to relive and feel again that sense of loss in a much more public way that you can do up to a certain point when people are dying in your local community. But there were so many deaths in the Civil War that even communities couldn't keep up with all of them.
It's almost what you're saying is that people, he became a symbol for all the other deaths as well. And when you say the last casualty of the war, even if that's not technically true in terms of time, it was symbolically true. And if he was seen as a casualty of war, you can see how people would use his funeral to mourn other casualties of war and attach their own grief to the national grief. It's a fascinating connection that you're making there.
Yes, that's exactly right. The only thing I would add is that the funeral, which was a very meant to be and was in many ways a very majestic and resplendent public ritual. What was so interesting about reading the private sources, the personal sources, the diaries and letters, is that you also see another side, so that all the people who are waiting in long lines to go see Lincoln's body. They'll say, oh, everyone was pushing and shoving, and I barely had a chance, and the guard moved me along, and I could barely see his face. And besides, his face was decaying and didn't really look very majestic. Or people would say, well, it was a very majestic ceremony, but my pocket was picked. So you get, or I couldn't hear anything. I was standing in the back of the crowd.
It's all very human.
There were no microphones. Very human. Absolutely. I was tired. I was hot. It was dusty. So it was fascinating to see people wanting this to be such an important moment. And for many it was, but others making clear the human dimension of all of these great festive ceremonies. The music wasn't loud enough. The lines were straggling. All of those things are in the personal sources.
Martha Hodes, her new book is called Mourning Lincoln. And we're going to get to callers in just a second. One mourner in particular you write a whole chapter about is Mary Lincoln. And the devastating impact. She was not a particularly stable person before, by all accounts, but this had a devastating effect on his wife.
I have in the book what I call an interlude about Mary Lincoln, and she was so important to people have written books about Mary Lincoln, but she was so important to Lincoln's mourners because people felt so bad for her. People realized at the time, stable, unstable, she was in the box when her husband was shot before her eyes,
This is Jackie Kennedy and
absolutely,
and John F. Kennedy.
Absolutely traumatic. And so in so many sources, men and women, diaries and letters, the phrase I saw over and over again, poor Mrs. Lincoln, poor Mrs. Lincoln. People write that constantly. Of course, she had also lost a son in 1859 and then a son in 1862.
Martha Hodes, her book is Mourning Lincoln. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. When we come back in just a minute, we'll go to your calls and your questions, so stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. This year's recipients and more information are at macfound.org. From Cancer Treatment Centers of America, where nutritional therapy is part of every patient's treatment plan to help boost their immune system and manage side effects while undergoing treatment. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And from the National Endowment for the Arts, art works.
If you have something to say, you say it. Are you lying to them? Are you lying?
No.
On the next Fresh Air, Benito Martinez, who co-stars in American Crime, the new ABC TV series, and John Ridley, creator and executive producer. The show set in Modesto, California, after a home invasion and murder, seen from the perspective of suspects, victims, and their families. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane, and my guest this hour, Martha Hodes, professor of history at New York University and author of the new book, Mourning Lincoln, obviously keyed to the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's death, which will be marked in just a few weeks. And Martha, I have some emails, and then we'll get to our callers. Here's one from Jean, who writes to us, part of my sadness regarding Lincoln's assassination has always been the question forever unanswered. Regarding our country truly being able to heal during Reconstruction, would we have been able to rid ourselves of the pain of slavery and the divisiveness of Reconstruction with his leadership? This is a question that's constantly asked, and I'm sure you get all the time. What if Lincoln had lived?
The question of whether Lincoln would have been able to heal the country had he lived is a question all historians of the Civil War get all the time. The first answer is, of course, we cannot know. But what I will say, and I know this from my own research for this book, is that Lincoln would have done one thing that Andrew Johnson did not do. He would have listened to his black petitioners, the African Americans who came to the White House, said to Andrew Johnson, think about what your noble predecessor would have done. This is what I was saying about African Americans and their white allies making Lincoln, fashioning him into a radical. Frederick Douglass said Lincoln's death was, his words, an unspeakable calamity for the African American people. Lincoln would have listened, just as he listened to Douglass and the more radical members of his own party during the Civil War. He would have acted the statesman and diplomat as he always did. But there is this sense, we don't know if it's true, there is a sense that he would have been able to move forward in more radical directions and in ways that would have possibly appeased both sides, although we can't forget the Confederates despised him. So hard to say, but he certainly would have been better than Andrew Johnson, who's consistently voted the worst president in American history by the public.
And of course, one of the words that comes up repeatedly in depictions of Lincoln, particularly in the South, is ape. This is a white man, but there's a racist element there. So as you say, as we were saying earlier, the power of the emotions that he generated on both sides were very, very strong.
Yes, there was one Confederate diary, a young woman who called Lincoln and Seward. Seward was also attacked by one of the conspirators, a royal suite of imperial apes. And she called the assassination a gleam of light in this midnight darkness, which was Confederate defeat.
Let's turn to our callers. We've got some good ones who want to join our conversation. And Ken in Kent County, Maryland. Ken, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning. I'd like to congratulate the professor on his new work. It's very important stuff. I'm from the smallest county in Maryland. It's only 1,000 or 2,000 bigger than it was in 1860, when only three people or so voted for Abraham Lincoln in this county. I'm going to quote from my three greats grandfather, Sewell Hebron. My middle name is Hepburn. I'm on his farm. This is also Catherine Hepburn's great grandfather. He was held in jail at Fort McHenry for what was titled Unpatriotic Speech. There's a whole novel to be written about that. But I would like to read from the postscript of a weekly letter he had to send to the provost marshal, and I'd be happy to share the source of this at the National Archives with the professor if she's interested. Great trove there. It is dated April 17, 1865, and it's postmarked Still Pond, Kent County, Maryland, about 3 miles from where I am. Dear sir, please accept this as my 11th weekly report and oblige. Your very respectfully, Sewell Hebron. P.S. I was at the post office on Saturday when the news came of the president's assassination. And when it was announced, consternation and alarm pervaded the whole around without respect to party. All good men must deplore this dreadful calamity. Good God, what's to become of us? S.H. I again think that what the professor's done up at NYU is very important. It's an ongoing conversation. She may be interested in speaking with Professor Striner, who has Washington College near here, who has a new book about the second inauguration speech. Now I'm interested in finding out whether my three greats grandfather would have been exposed to that a month earlier. It seems that he may have been.
We really appreciate the call. I assume Kent County is Kent Island.
No, Kent Island is actually in Queen Anne's County, but Kent County is just south of the Sassafras River, north of the Chester River. We're a peninsula that's basically just east of Aberdeen Proving Grounds, U.S. Army.
Oh, all right. I know where that is. Thanks very much for the call. We really appreciate it.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Fascinating document. Thanks for that. Lots of elements of that are fascinating. without respect to party, very interesting point. People sometimes felt that genuinely. People sometimes said that to protect themselves if they were not feeling consternation over the assassination. Unpatriotic speech, also very interesting, because Unionists and Northerners were brought up on charges of treason if they maligned Lincoln in public after the assassination. They were brought up on charges of accessories to the assassination after the fact, usually Union soldiers and sailors. And those documents are in the National Archives, and they're absolutely fascinating.
And one of the things that our caller, and it was such a useful call, pointed out that Maryland was a slaveholding state which stayed in the Union, but it was touch and go there for a long time, and a very critical dimension, because if Maryland had joined the Confederacy, Washington would have been surrounded by Confederate states. But that even so, Lincoln was not what you would call a popular figure, since virtually no one in Maryland voted for him.
What was so fascinating about the four border states, of which Maryland was one, was that during the assassination, you could really see the divisions between people who were mourning Lincoln and people who were gleeful about his assassination. And those clashes took place in villages, on roads, in the streets. People were infuriated with one another. People were responding to one another, most especially in those border states.
Let's turn to Tom in New Bedford, Massachusetts. Tom, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. This is a fascinating topic, especially in light of the previous hour's discussion. As a Civil War historian, I wonder if Professor Hose would mind commenting on two claims made in that hour, specifically that the war started when the North invaded the South, and that the war was not fought over slavery.
Sure. Thank you for that. Well, the causes of the Civil War at root were about the extension of slavery across the country, extension of slavery into Western territories. And Northerners and Southerners, or slaveholding and non-slaveholding states, had very different visions about that. Northerners wanted the extension of free labor. White Southerners wanted the extension of slave labor. So that also answers your second question, which was that the war was about slavery. And one of the best pieces of evidence for that is the Confederate Constitution, the first article of the Confederate Constitution, which resembles the U.S. Constitution in many ways, has a provision that says no law against slavery or against stopping slavery can ever be passed. I also would say one other thing, which is that even though most white Southerners did not own slaves, they still had a stake in a system of racial slavery.
And, of course, the question of states' rights is inseparable from the question of slavery on some level, because it was the state's right to defend slavery. So those are not separate arguments in at least in one dimension, right?
Yes. And what's so fascinating is that in at least one of the letters or diaries I saw, in many letters and diaries, people blamed slavery for the assassination. And at least one person wrote, it is slavery and states' rights, the accursed system of slavery and states' rights. So that was also paired at the time.
And Martha, let's turn to, we have Jim in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jim, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. Jim, are you there? All right.
Yes, sir.
Go
Hello?
Ahead. Jim, you're on the yes. air. Welcome.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Yes. I'm actually writing a book about the James Garfield I'm supposing what would have happened, as you just mentioned, had he lived. He was a very strong advocate of civil rights, and in fact, in his inaugural speech, he advocated for the integration of schools almost immediately. And I'm curious, he's very rarely spoken about because his presidency was so short, but you mentioned Kennedy, of course, as a reflection of Lincoln's analog of Lincoln's assassination. But I guess almost as an aside to this, as a professor of history in that era, what impact do you think Garfield's death had in the whole evolution of civil rights?
Well, what's so interesting,
Jim, thanks for the call. Thanks. Go ahead. Press.
What's so interesting, thank you, about Garfield and the other assassination, which was McKinley in 1901 and Garfield was 1881, is that they're not remembered the way Lincoln and Kennedy are remembered. And yet you are quite right.
Or even Martin Luther King.
Or King. Absolutely. Martin Luther King in 1968. Garfield was a very interesting president, a very good man. And Candace Millard has written a wonderful book about him. But he isn't well remembered. And I think it is because two reasons. One is because of the length of his presidency, which was very short. And the other is that he and McKinley did not die instantly. And that seems to have made a difference in the way they were thought of afterwards. Lincoln and Kennedy died much more immediately after the assassination. I think Garfield's a very important man, and I'm very happy to hear that more books are being written about him.
But you also point out in your book that there was this dimension of Lincoln being the first assassinated president, and that resonated in a special way. That helped add to the sense of national shock, even though, as we talked about, it was a period of enormous carnage and mourning and devastation. We hadn't gone through as a nation the experience of an assassination before.
And that was what made Lincoln's assassination, the nation's first presidential assassination, unimaginable. And that did contribute to this incredible horror, this sense that it was a dream, or as people said, I thought it was a play on a stage. Today we would say, I thought I was in a movie. I felt like I was in a movie. Mm-hmm. And constantly people use this 19th century locution, realize, I cannot realize it.
Let's turn to Tim in Elsa, Illinois. Tim, welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to join in the conversation. I'm heading up a group of three local historical societies. We've built a coffin which resembles the one that carried Lincoln's body from Washington back to Springfield 150 years ago. Because of our association with the river here, we call it the Great Rivers Lincoln Coffin, and it will be the official coffin for the reenactment ceremonies in Springfield on May 2nd and 3rd, shortly about 6 weeks from now. The coffin, folks, is based on the Jeremiah Gurney photograph of Lincoln lying in state in New York City Hall on April 25, 1865. And what the comments Martha made about the coffin being resplendent and magnificent bring to mind exactly what we've done in producing this replica. It's a museum quality, very, very handsome piece, but it's elegant and it befits a president. And I think this is what people saw in the journey from Washington to Springfield. Not everybody was able to go into the state houses, but they lined the streets, as you were saying earlier, and this is the image that they saw when they were confronting the death of this president.
Stay on the line. I'm Steve Roberts. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Talk about this coffin and this reenactment, and how 150 years later, there's still people have this impulse to do exactly what our caller is doing.
Absolutely. I will, in fact, be in Springfield, Illinois, for the anniversary of Lincoln's burial. So that was at the end of this two-week journey across the country. May 4th, he was buried, and I will be part of a scholarly symposium there with other Lincoln scholars. And it tells us, just as you were implying, it tells us how important this is, how the reenactment is also a way to help us all these years later, 150 years later, realize, as I was saying before, make this real. It's still something that in many ways is shocking.
Tim, tell us about your own motives and impulses to be part of this process. And not just remembering Lincoln, but this physical act of building the coffin must have had a special meaning for you. Tell our listeners why you did this.
Well, we're part of a local history group, Steve, and the state of Illinois volunteer group throughout the state are coming together. This is the land of Lincoln. And we're close by the city where the last of the Lincoln-Douglas debates were held. And so there's a warm spot in our heart for all of this. So that was the primary motive, bringing our group together to work with this. And everything is volunteered as part of this thing. The lumber came from a St. Louis lumber company that began in 1874. So our boxes, our coffin is made of walnut. As was the original coffin. It's completely covered with black wool broadcloth donated by Brooks Brothers. And the connection there is Brooks Brothers made a great coat for Lincoln to be worn at his second inaugural.
That's
and
right.
The folks in New York, when we were asked for help about getting the measurements as correct as we could possibly make them, they said, well, we'll send you the coat and let you examine that carefully, and we'll send you drawings like that. People in Batesville, Indiana, at the Batesville Casket Company, put together a they they decorated the box for us, and so we have an amazing piece of work that's going to be seen in Springfield, Martha, on May 2nd and 3rd. You're going to be there. I'll be there, too, at the symposium run by Michael Burlingame and other Lincoln scholars. So to your question, Steve, it's a labor of love for a lot of people here in Illinois.
I would only add that it's going to be a wonderful ceremony, but part of what I did in Mourning Lincoln was I tried to move away from the idealizing and to get the whole human story of the funeral and the funeral train and people's responses.
But also what this, and thank you so much for your call. I really added a lot to the broadcast. We appreciate it, Tim. But this, we talked throughout this hour about the veneration. You talked about how there's not the same for McKinley and Garfield. There's something deeper about Lincoln, something where people, we talked about the relics people save, the pilgrimages. These are religious notions. They're spiritual notions as well as political notions. And this act of love that Tim described of building this casket is a perfect modern symbol of exactly what we're talking about.
Lincoln was assassinated after a four-year civil war. It was a moment that's unparalleled. Nothing can parallel that. He was also charismatic. He was brilliant. He was enigmatic. And one of the things I found in personal writings over and over again was the word love. We loved Lincoln. Men and women wrote that. We loved him. And although I had great admiration for Lincoln teaching the Civil War for 20-plus years, I grew to love him as I wrote the book.
Just as Tim said. Good note to end the conversation on. Martha Hodes, professor at NYU. Mourning Lincoln is her new book. 150th anniversary of his assassination coming up in just a few weeks. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Thanks for spending an hour of your morning with us.
Thanks.